James, welcome to Bay Area Innovators.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Awesome to have you here. So World War II, there's been so much written about it, so many movies, so much discussion. You have this new book, Empire of Ashes, that talks about the last few months of the World War II and what transpired, and of course the major decision, which was to drop atomic bombs in Japan. Why are we talking about this now? It's been almost 81 years ago that this happened. Why are you bringing this up right now?
It's incredibly relevant. You know, we are, for the first time really in a long period, are having to have a sort of a national and global discussion about nuclear weapons. I mean, with the war going on in Ukraine, Russia's been threatening the use of them. We're at war with Iran, trying to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. So, I mean, pretty much everywhere in today's society, that discussion is being had. And so it's an incredibly topical opportunity to sort of take a look back and say, okay, let's look at when they were actually used. Let's look at the decision-making that went involved, the circumstances that went involved, the outcomes that were associated with it, and what can we sort of take away from the end of World War II that is applicable today with everything going on in today's global conflicts.
Well, we look forward to a nice lesson in history on this. Now, you start your book with a vivid description of FDR's last days, and he's such an amazing president, right? He was elected four times, and of course, this is before the constitutional amendment that would limit two terms. And then you quote some amazing things, which I wasn't familiar with. The U.S. military was ranked 19th in the world in 1933, in the middle of the Great Depression, of course. And you mentioned in your book, between Bulgaria and Portugal, and he ends up making the U.S. the greatest military power in the world in just a few years. Tell us more about how did you get all this information, and you know, how did you plan this in your beginning of the book?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, so much as this book really looks at the last 125 days of World War II, and it's an incredibly pivotal moment in history. And what's also so amazing about that is it really ultimately is going to turn on a neophyte, Harry Truman. And as you noted, I mean, the book begins on the day that FDR dies. And it's important for audiences to remember what an effect FDR had on American society. I mean, he was president for over 4,000 days. If you were in middle school in 1945, you knew no other president except FDR. And of course, as you noted, he came into power in 1933 during the banking crisis. He steered the nation through the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, the outbreak of World War I, the militarization of the United States, the buildup, the fighting of the war, all the way up until the very end. He's the one that's in charge. And so, and Truman, in contrast, you know, he's not college educated. He's from a small town out in Missouri. You know, he's a product of rural America. I mean, he spends the first decade of his adulthood working on his family farm. You know, he goes on as a failed businessman in many ways, and he goes off to war in World War I. I mean, he's a unique candidate to follow FDR, and it's a big surprise for America when he takes over. Not only is the death of FDR after 12 years such a shock, but Truman is a relative nobody for the American public. And one of my favorite lines is, you know, Admiral William Leahy, who was the de facto chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when Truman is ultimately picked to be FDR's running mate, he exclaims, well, who the heck is Harry Truman? And that kind of sums up, if you got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs doesn't know who he is, how can you expect the average American to really have any understanding? And of course, to Harry Truman falls this massive responsibility of like, how do I end this war? How do I secure the peace? How do I prevent an outbreak in the future of another type of conflict like World War II?
Yeah, so tell us more about the pressure that Harry Truman faced. I know in your book you describe how he's being informed of the death of FDR. He didn't even know, you know, what that might be. He thought maybe it's some news that has to do with the war. Tell us about the pressures that he was facing at the time.
Absolutely. You know, and what adds to that pressure is the fact that is that FDR didn't really tell him anything. I mean, FDR was notorious for kind of keeping all of the information close. He ran the government. You know, he didn't really tell Harry Truman anything. He basically told Truman, just go back to the Senate, do what you're comfortable with. I've got it from here. And so when Truman takes over, you know, he comes in. The Battle of Okinawa is raging in the Pacific, which is going to be the worst fight of the Pacific for American forces. Germany is about to collapse. He's got the Manhattan Project, which he doesn't know anything about, is about to come online. He's got, you know, to deal with negotiations with the British, with the Russians, the Chinese. I mean, he's just got this massive, massive learning curve that he's got to figure out how to master in an extraordinarily short period of time.
How did Truman find out about the details of the bomb?
Well, you know, Truman had kind of brushed up against the atomic bomb during his days in the Senate. And during his time in the Senate, he'd kind of, the one area he had sort of been a standout in while a lawmaker was that he had run what was called the Truman Commission. And that was a committee that was designed to sort of look for any waste in war expenditures. And it was during that time that some of his investigators actually paid a visit to Hanford, Washington, which was the top secret atomic city where plutonium was manufactured. And of course, his investigators were turned away. And so Henry Stimson, who was the war secretary, subsequently reaches out to Truman. And he basically tells Truman, he said, I can't tell you what's going on out there. It's part of a secret project that only a handful of people know about. But I can assure you it is being managed properly and you don't need to worry. And Truman takes him at his word. He says, look, that's what you tell me, I will trust you. You know, you're honorable man, war secretary, whatnot, we will move on.
And this is when Truman was a senator.
Yes, this is when he was a senator. So this is about 1944, earlier on than that. So what happens then is the night Truman is sworn in, Stimson pulls him aside and he says, you and I need to get together after you sort of get your feet on the ground. And I need to kind of bring you up to speed on a new project we've got going on that is going to be pretty transformative potentially for the war. But of course, Truman at that, he's just, you know, being sworn in as president that night. He's dealing with the press. He's dealing with his family. He's dealing with all the chaos of it. So Stimson allows, you know, about 10 or 12 days to pass before he reaches back out to Truman. And he sends him a note. And he says, about that thing I mentioned to you, it's time we get together. Truman then agrees to meet. They meet the next day. And they meet, it is Truman, it is Stimson, and it is General Leslie Groves. And General Leslie Groves may probably be best known to most folks as Matt Damon in the film Oppenheimer. And that's, of course, Leslie Groves was the general in charge of the Manhattan Project. And he is the doer, so to speak. And if you look at the Manhattan Project, you really think Henry Stimson was kind of the chairman of the board and Leslie Groves was the CEO. So he really ran the day-to-day operations and whatnot. It was just, I mean, 100% versed in all the nuts and bolts of that very complex, large project. And so the two of them get together with Truman for about an hour and they brief him. They walk him through exactly what's going on, not only the development of the bomb, what the bomb entails, but also the post-war concerns that this might spark an arms race. You know, all of these kind of things that had been debated inside the Manhattan Project of what would happen once you unleash an atomic weapon on the world. And so he has basically an hour to absorb all of this information. And of course, it's a huge issue at that point. It's a huge topic. The bomb is not yet ready. It is not going to be tested for several more months still, but it is coming to that point. It is rapidly approaching the time when America is going to know one way or the other whether this bomb.
How aware were they of the destruction that the bomb can do and how many lives would be lost and just of the raw destruction? Were they aware of it?
They were. I mean, but you have to remember, at this point, it's all theoretical. And so they know that this is going to be a massive explosion. They know that it is going to lead to significant civilian lives. Just how big of an explosion it's going to be really still remains a theory. And it's not going to be until they actually test the bomb in July of 1945 that they're going to sort of begin to wrap their head around just how destructive it is and start to make sort of extrapolations about what we could expect from the first couple of bombs that are going to be ready in August. They had an idea. We weren't going to spend that kind of money and move heaven and earth to build these projects if we didn't think that they were going to be potentially game changers in the war.
Now we got to take a look at the situation in Japan. So of course, Germany surrendered, Russian troops and American troops and French and English, they control Europe. However, Japan is not surrendering. And it seems like there would be a large loss of life on the American side in order to occupy Japan, right?
Yeah. And I spent a lot of time looking at what's going on in Japan. I think that's something that's missing from a lot of contemporary American accounts and histories, is sort of what is happening in Japan, not just from a political level, but also from a societal level. And what has happened in Japan, of course, at this point, is that they're, quite frankly, they're losing the war. I mean, Japan had built this empire that literally encompassed about a quarter of the globe. And from 1942 on to 1945, that has increasingly been shrinking down and down and down, all the way back now till the Japanese homeland is now within reach of American bombers. And what happens starting in March of 1945 is America begins a pretty dramatic firebombing campaign against the Japanese home islands. This is going to be run out of the Mariana Islands of Guam, Saipan, and Tinian by General Curtis LeMay. And these are extraordinarily successful and violent raids, and so much so that by August of 1945, literally 64 Japanese cities are going to have about 170 square miles burned out of them. But the firebombings are only one part of the pressure that is on Japanese leaders at that point. America's also been running a very successful submarine blockade of Japan for many, many years at this point. Japan is an island nation. It's about 85% mountainous, so it is self-sufficient in only a handful of natural resources, things like sulfur and fish oil, which, quite frankly, are not things you need in abundance. So they are dependent upon imports for everything, including food, fuel, and raw materials to feed their war industries. So what's happened with the submarine blockade is it's increasingly cut off Japan's abilities to get those supplies. That's having a huge impact on the war. Japan simply can't get enough fuel to be able to power its warships and its planes. That's going to lead to kamikazes. They can't get enough food for the population, which is going to lead to malnourishment, a thriving black market, and the beginning of the breakdown of the social fabric there. In fact, by the end of the war, the average Japanese person is going to be living on about 1,600 calories a day. And that's, of course, that's too few to be able to survive and function. Average Japanese person is also going to be spending about 5 hours each day figuring out where their next meal is coming from. You're going to see a rise in infant mortality rates, a rise in children developing rickets. New mothers are going to be so malnourished they can't produce milk. Japan's literally going to experiment with giving newborns radish and turnip juice, which just sounds terrible to me, but you have to do what you have to do to survive. And so what you're seeing is sort of a struggle at every level of Japanese society. And yet, despite all that, Japan is committed to fighting on. Well, why is that? Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, yes, their Navy has largely been destroyed. Yes, their Air Force has pretty much been destroyed as well. And what's left of it is being converted to kamikaze attacks, planes. But Japan still has a very sizable army, about 5 million men under arms. And the army has not yet been defeated on a battlefield.
They still had 5 million at that time.
5 million, yeah. And Japan's more militarist leaders are arguing that we haven't been defeated yet. In fact, we haven't even really tangled one-on-one on any real large scale with the American army. So we're not ready to surrender. And of course, the Americans at this point are demanding unconditional surrender. Of course, that has become one of the most popular slogans of the war. Everybody in America knows it. It's been preached for years now. And what does unconditional surrender mean? Well, it means that the Americans are going to come into Germany after the war. They're going to come into Japan after the war. They're going to remake these societies because World War II grows out of the embers of World War I. And they don't want that to happen again. We don't want to have to relitigate these wars every two decades. And so the idea is if the Allies can remake these societies, change the government, change the laws, you know, prosecute the offenders, then you can eliminate this from happening and prevent this from happening.
Well, that actually answers partly one of my other questions, which was, why wasn't the United States thinking of settling in a more neutral way the Japanese situation, something like what happened in Korea, in the Korean War? Not that there was a good outcome necessarily, but was there thinking in there?
Well, the challenge that Truman faces at this point is that so much of the American public is now wedded to this idea. It's become such a popular slogan. It's become such a it's in the media. It's, everybody knows it. That to change would be a pretty significant public relations issue for them, effectively. And quite frankly, you would also be sending a message. This was the fear of George Marshall's, that we'd be sending the message that the Japanese were being successful in their war against us. We'd be sending the wrong message, which is, you know, that we're not going soft, but that we are not willing to prosecute the war all the way to the end. And that was a real concern for George Marshall, and particularly because Germany does collapse and we do get that kind of surrender from the Germans. And we were really adamant that we had to have the same against Japan. Now, there were voices inside the US government that said, hey, you know what, wait a second. We don't have to fight this war all the way to a huge bloody conclusion. One of the big points that the Japanese militarists really want is they want to be able to protect the emperor and the monarchy. And you know what? Maybe that's not a bad idea. Maybe Hirohito could be a tool for us in bringing about peace, because he is this one central figure in Japanese culture and Japanese life. And if we preserve him and we get him to help order everybody to sort of lay down arms and whatnot, we might be able to prevent a huge bloody guerrilla war after this. And that was a big concern. Japan has that many troops who've not yet been defeated on the battlefield. It's not so much that you have to win, but you have to prevent it. You know, you have to secure the peace on top of winning the war. And the big fear was, if you have all these Japanese soldiers and they end up in a guerrilla war, then the U.S. has a disaster on its hands. And so that's sort of the rise in the power of the emperor in the eyes of many folks inside the State Department, for example.
Now, what... Is there an estimate of what would have been the loss of American life if Japan was to be invaded, the same as Normandy in France?
Absolutely. And it's important to remember, at this point, by the time we use the atomic weapons in August, Truman has already greenlit the first part of that invasion. Now, Operation Downfall was what the invasion of the Japanese home islands was called. And it was a two-pronged assault. The first part was going to be the island of Kyushu in November of 1945. The second part was going to be the main island of Honshu in March of 1946. Now, Truman on June 18th gives approval for the invasion of Kyushu. Now, what's happening at this point is, as I noted, Japan has a whole lot of troops, and they can see where the Americans are going next. If you look at a map of the Pacific, it's like we're just climbing up this ladder towards the Japanese home islands. And they can see that after Okinawa, Kyushu is where we're headed next. And so they start rushing reinforcements down to the southern island there. So much so that what we initially think is going to be a 3-to-1 ratio when Americans come ashore, which is 3 American troops for every 1 Japanese, suddenly gets knocked down to 2-to-1 and then down to 1-to-1. And at that point, we're literally looking at about 900,000 Japanese troops on Kyushu by the time of the invasion. And that is a recipe for disaster. And what we've seen increasingly in the last year of the war is that Japanese battlefield tactics have changed. Japan is no longer committed towards, you know, an outright victory. It's really now more about attrition and a bloodletting of the American forces. In Japan's view is, if they can create such a grind and a casualty count for the Americans, that the Americans will give up on unconditional surrender and let Japan keep the emperor, maybe not have an occupation. That's another thing that the Japanese leaders don't want. They also don't want to have their troops put on trial by Allied War Commission, War Tribunal. So that's kind of the hope there. And so not only are we facing an invasion, now we're facing what's going to be a really bloody invasion because of the way Japan has changed its tactics. And on top of all that, Japan's now recruiting average civilians as part of this national civilian army. So grandparents all the way down to middle schoolers are being trained to fight with spears and whatnot to defend the home islands. So America is facing a horrific invasion. Now, one Pentagon estimate, as you asked, in the summer of 1945, saying that an invasion could cost America 1.7 to 4 million casualties. The Japanese, in contrast, would be 5 to 10 million. So again, these are projections. Fortunately, we never had to go through with that invasion, but it gives you a sense of kind of where analysts were in the summer of 1945 in anticipating just how awful this invasion.
Well, so clearly looking at those numbers, the numbers that were lost because of the bomb are much smaller. Now, tell us a bit about Emperor Hirohito's role in all of this and the dynamics in the Japanese society.
And that's such an important part. And as you know from the subtitle of the book, it's Truman and Hirohito. And because, you know, Hirohito in a lot of ways is sort of Truman's counterpart on the opposite side of the Pacific. And by saying that, however, I mean, there's really no similarity between these two guys other than that they both appreciate history, I think. You know, Hirohito, of course, is a monarch. You know, he grows up sort of in cut off from Japanese society, part of an imperial family. He is at the center of Japanese cultural, political, spiritual life. But he is not like a commander in chief, like how we have in the United States. I mean, he does give his blessing over things that happen. But when you think about sort of a wartime leader, Emperor Hirohito is not going to be the image that jumps in your mind. He is not Napoleon Bonaparte. He is not Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great. He is, quite frankly, more of an absent-minded professor in a lot of ways. He is a slender figure. He's got stooped shoulders. He's very introverted. He has a high-pitched voice. He has a habit of talking to himself when he gets nervous. He's, quite frankly, he's more cerebral. He's interested in marine biology. He collected starfish. He is interested in history. He's very fascinated by Abraham Lincoln. But he is not a gregarious, outgoing, commanding presence or figure in any way, shape, or form.
Was he in charge of the military?
Yes, he is. Effectively, yes. In name, if nothing else. And he does have to give his blessing. But what has happened is, as Hirohito ascends to the throne in the 1920s, in Japanese culture, particularly during the 1920s, 1930s, is changing. Its political culture is going through a dramatic change at that period. And what you're seeing then is the consolidation of power by the Japanese military. And so even though Japan is in theory a democracy and whatnot, what you're really seeing is an erosion of democratic values and institutions during that time period. As the military goes, they go after the press. You know, they start cutting down all these newspapers and shrinking them down. And in its place is going to go Domai, which is sort of a wire service, but it's a propaganda arm. They're going to go after academics and sort of attacks on sort of liberal institutions, trade unions. They're going to change the curriculum in schools to emphasize nationalism and the monarchy. They're going to put military leaders inside schools to teach children about training and fitness. And so they're also going to start organizing Japanese society down into neighborhood associations with monitors. And the idea is that it's really, it's not so much a monitor, but it's somebody who can pass out information from the government to, you know, every 20 households. But it's really kind of a way to keep tabs. And of course, they're going to create a thought police. And they're going to create laws to ban, you know, organized protests and whatnot. So you're going to see these guardrails that sort of protect public rights begin to fall off. On top of all this, you're going to see a huge rise in political violence. Political violence was very common in Japanese culture at that point. Assassinations. In fact, Admiral Suzuki, who was the prime minister at the end of the war, had barely survived an assassination attempt in the 1930s. In fact, he still had a bullet lodged inside him. And of course, these threats, the emperor was not immune to them. There had been threats against the emperor's life. And so over Hirohito always, and over every Japanese leader, hangs this threat of political violence. You either toe the line or watch out. And so Hirohito knows that. And so at the outbreak of the war, he's not really so much in favor of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the outbreak of the war. In fact, he hems and haws for the better part of about a month before he ultimately gives his blessing. And because he, you know, it's like peer pressure to sort of, you know, to follow what the military wants to do, even though his heart's not in it. He's going to go along with that for much of the war. It's not until 1945, when Japan's fortunes become crystal clear that it is losing the war and that it's likely going to lose the war, that Hirohito starts realizing, I've got to sort of insert myself more in this political process. I've got to sort of pressure and push our government in a way to find a solution to the war before it ends up being a bloody invasion and a huge catastrophe for the Japanese public.
So in your opinion, was the use of the bomb justified?
Yeah, and it's one of those things, it's a tough question. You know, people always ask, you know, was the bomb necessary? Were there other options and things like that? And over the years, people have thrown out ideas like, well, why didn't they do a test of the bomb? Why didn't they do an example, things like that. And it's important to remember that a lot of those arguments that are made today were actually debated in 1945. And for instance, you hear the common thing, well, why wasn't a test of this done? Well, you know, one of the big concerns with doing a test was, what if the bomb doesn't work? And that was a real fear, you know, that and of course, the bomb's value to Japan was as a political weapon. I mean, you have to remember, after firebombing 64 Japanese cities, after destroying 56 square miles of Tokyo, even though the atomic bomb is a powerful weapon, it's not that powerful. And so the bomb was needed as a way to shock the Japanese political system. And so if you tell the Japanese, we've got this bomb and we're going to give you an example and we drop this test bomb and it doesn't work, you've lost that whole shock value. The other idea, the other fear was that, okay, well, let's say we do that. We tell Japan we're going to drop it on this one place in Japanese culture, you know, Japanese island or whatnot, beach. Well, what if they take all the American POWs that they have or allied POWs? And what if they go put them there and we ultimately drop a bomb and kill all of our own people? And then really, in the end, it kind of came down to the question of what was the bomb really about? And it fell back on that shock value. And so if you're going to really shock the Japanese leaders, you just can't tell them you got it. And so that ultimately is kind of the fallback of, like, we can't do that. Now, that those debates about how best to use the bomb were widely held inside the Manhattan Project, not only amongst the scientists, but also amongst political leaders before that decision was made. Now, I think when it comes to whether or not the bomb was necessary or not, all you have to do is really look at the historical record from the Japanese side to understand that it was, that Japan had been committed to fight to the end. It's not the first bomb is dropped on Hiroshima on August 6th. That one bomb does not actually convince the Japanese to surrender. In fact, that they don't. The Japan's War Council doesn't even get together right away after that. But the second bomb plays a very significant role in changing the dynamic inside Japanese politics at that point. And one of the arguments that was advanced by Japan's militarists after the first bomb was dropped, because as soon as it's dropped, America announces, we've dropped this new weapon, it's an atomic bomb. People have to remember, atomic bombs, Japan had a program, they were trying to develop one, the Germans were, the Russians were. Atomic energy was a very big topic in the 1930s and 1940s. It was the equivalent of AI today, so everybody knew about it. So America's the first one there. So when America drops the bomb, we announce we have dropped an atomic bomb. Now, inside Japanese political debates, one of the arguments advanced was atomic bombs are new, they're expensive, there's no way the Americans have more than one of these things. And so therefore, our regime is still intact. We can keep fighting. It is then that the America drops that second bomb. And dropping that second bomb 75 hours after the first sends a message to the Japanese that if the Americans can drop these things back to back, they may have an entire arsenal of them. They may have 100 of them. So at that point, they may never invade. The Americans may just sit offshore and continue to drop bombs every few days until there's nothing left of Japan. And that really becomes sort of the game-changing decision point for the Japanese. Because at this point, what the Japanese military wants, they want to get the Americans on shore. They want to then unleash all these troops that they have, not only their troops, but their citizen army, to create this bloodbath against the Americans and convince the Americans that unconditional surrender will never work, and therefore they can have a better position at the bargaining table.
So it changes all their whole mentality, their whole plan of continuing the war.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Their whole end game goes out the window. And that gives Hirohito the opening to say, we got to get out of this war now.
How many bombs did the U.S. have at that time?
Two. And I'll tell you, that's one of the most fascinating moments, I think, of this thing. Is because what happens is the second bomb originally was not scheduled to be dropped until August 11th. And you've got Leslie Groves and you've got Curtis LeMay. And of course, these guys are both, you know, they're army guys. They understand the initiative. And both of them say, you know what? That's too long. You can't go August 6th to August 11th. And so you've got to move heaven and earth to get this second bomb ready as fast as possible. Now, these bombs are being prepped on the small island of Tinian, which is this amazing little island in the middle of the Pacific. I love going to Tinian. I've visited there many times. But it's on that island that they are assembling the parts of these bombs. And so, and the Manhattan Project scientists that are out there are under all this pressure to hurry up, get that second bomb ready, get that air crew ready, get that bomb on Japan, because what they're trying to do is send that message to the Japanese. We've got a million of these things if necessary. You know, we can do it day after day after day. And so it's a psychological gamble in a lot of ways that you're playing there with the Japanese.
Yeah, it's like a poker game.
It's exactly like poker. And it worked. And it convinces the Japanese, hey, the Americans could have 20 of these things, 30 of these things.
Yeah. Now, the island you mentioned, is that where the Enola Gay airplane took off with the first bomb?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the island of Tinian. And I'll tell you this, I've got right here, this is a piece of the runway. from the Enola Gay. And if you'll see here, it's made out of coral, because it's a big coral island. And so the U.S. Captured it in the summer of 1944 and turned this island into a massive American air base. And if you go visit Tinian today, those runways are still there, although they're being repurposed now for future use. So the Air Force is there now. But all the roads around there are the original roads that were built by the Seabees over 8 decades ago. So it's I take tourists out there and I love visiting it because there's just so much history. The Enola Gay took off from there, and Boxcar, which is the B-29 that bombed Nagasaki, both took off from runway Able there.
Now, you know, as interesting as it is historically, after World War II, our friends kind of became our enemies and our enemies became our friends. What is your thought going forward as far as we always think of China as a concern in the Pacific? Is in some way China replacing Japan as far as the concern there in the Pacific?
Absolutely. No. And you see that. I'll tell you, I go out to the Pacific every spring and I do tours. So I go to the Philippines. I go to the Mariana Islands. I go out to the Palau. And you see, like, runway Able, which is the famous runway where the Enola Gay took off from. The Air Force is redoing that runway right now, repaving it, bringing it back into use. On the island of Peleliu, which, of course, was the horrific battle in October of 1944, the fall of 1944, the Marines are redoing the airfield there as well. In the Philippines, where we left the Philippines in the 1990s at the behest of the Philippine government, at that point, after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo destroyed Clark Air Force Base, we are now building more airfields and bases there in the Philippines. And all of this is a direct result of the rise of China. I mean, the Pacific is, there's a lot of tension there. You see Chinese warships pushing right up to the edge of the Philippines, all these pressures that are building. And so this is, a lot of the same places are in play. It's just a different adversary this time. I compare it to musical chairs. It's like, you know, music stops playing, everybody's kind of moving around, and it's just, but it's the same, you know, and the chairs are the same places, you know, the same islands.
Going back to the decision to use the bomb for a second, do you think FDR would have made the same decision and pretty much the same dynamics as Truman did?
Yes, absolutely. FDR was really hands-off in the day-to-day prosecution of the war. He never objected to the fire raids against Tokyo or any of Japan's other cities. So any of the kind of moral questions that sort of preceded the use of atomic weapons that would have arisen during the fire raids, he doesn't make any qualm about those. Also, Truman is using the same advisors that FDR had. It's Henry Stimson, it's Jimmy Burns, who's the Secretary of State, although under FDR, Burns was more of his, they called him the assistant president, he was more of a personal aide. But it's all, you know, Admiral Leahy, who's de facto chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. All of his advisors were the same advisors. And of course, Truman, they were all adamant to Truman at the time that he needed to use the weapon. Their advice would have been the same to FDR.
Do you think Truman was tougher on communism or on the Soviet Union than FDR was?
Well, I think at that time, yes, in 1945. And granted, I have not studied the post-war period and the Cold War period. I mean, there are a lot of scholars that have dug deep on that. I would leave it to them to discuss that. But during that brief period at the end of the war, I definitely think so. And FDR was used to sort of finessing other world leaders. And so Truman kind of comes in and he, you know, he's got a different style and he's got a learning curve. And so he's pretty harsh with, you know, Molotov, who's their foreign minister, and initially with Stalin and some of the communications and demands. But it's really, I think a lot of that is him sort of feeling out the dynamic in the Pacific. He's never met Stalin. He's never met Churchill. In fact, the first time he's ever going to meet them is going to be in July of 1945 when he meets him in the battered suburbs of Berlin at Potsdam. So he's having to kind of grapple with all of this. And of course, this is a very transformative period. I mean, World War II in Europe is coming to an end in May. You're going to start seeing the fall of the Iron Curtain. You know, Truman's inbox is going to be filled with messages from Churchill, who's alarmed at sort of Russian meddling in Poland and other countries. He's going to see that. He doesn't take it as seriously initially as he will later on. And of course, that's going to play a really big role in Japan, because as Russia's influence is pushing across Europe, Truman is going to realize, hey, we don't want that in Japan, and we need to keep the Russians out of Japan. And Japan is going to play a very important post-war role for the United States as a bulkhead against that rise of communism in Asia. And so Truman wises up by August and realizes we need to end the war. We need to keep Russia out of Japan. The Americans need to control the occupation.
Yeah, now maybe for me, I'm biased. I am originally from Romania. And of course, FDR, at the Yalta conference, when he met with Churchill and Stalin, he made these concessions to the Soviet Union that Soviet Union would control Eastern Europe. Had he not done that, I don't know if it would have been possible, but then those Eastern European countries would have been free of communism and free of the Russian influence at that time. Do you think Truman would have done differently at that conference?
That's a good question. You know, I've never thought about that. You know, and I don't know if he necessarily would have. I think FDR's gut instinct was, you know, he was giving concessions to the Soviets in order to kind of keep them churning up the Germans. And, you know, because Russia was such an important way to kind of grind down the German forces. And Stalin was really mad that it took so long for the Allies to come back to Europe. You know, because they go into North Africa and then they kind of come up, you know, through the Mediterranean. And it's not until, you know, the summer of 1944 that you see sort of the direct assault across the English Channel that, you know, a lot of those concessions, I think, were done to kind of placate Stalin so that he didn't make a separate peace with Germany, which would have then freed Germany up to turn its attention west against. So I don't know. You know, that's tough. That's a good question. I've never thought about that. Yeah. So, you stumped me on that one, Steve. The one thing I will add is, I mean, what happens in post-war Europe is what alarms Truman for Asia. I mean, he sees Russia's influence growing. He sees that, and he takes it seriously, and it causes him to block that in Japan, or to try to block that in Japan.
Now, tell us, why are you so interested in writing and studying the Pacific War versus, of course, the European theater? The war was maybe 10-1 ratio of how many movies, how much has been studied, and not the Pacific side. Tell us your interest in that.
You know, we need to change that, Steve. We need more movies out of the Pacific. We need more pop culture references. I spent my first year after college as a public school teacher in Japan. So this was many, many years ago, back in the late 1990s. And so my interest in the Pacific War really grew out of my personal experience in the Pacific of spending a year in Japan. At this point, there were still a lot of veterans. There were a lot of civilians who'd survived. I first learned about the fire raids, for example, by teaching a class at my local community center, a conversational English class. And so I visited Hiroshima for the first time in 1997, 1998. So a lot of my interest grew out of that. And so I started studying it. But for me, I think what is so often lost is that everybody thinks of they love the European theater, but America's role in the European theater is part of an allied coalition. It's largely the American army sort of fighting alongside the British and whatnot. Whereas the Pacific theater is such a uniquely American experience. I mean, we control that theater. And you see every service branch plays a vital role, a transformative role in a lot of ways. I mean, it's the Marines who are having to figure out how to storm different beachheads and how to refine their tactics for amphibious warfare, change their vehicles in order to get over reefs and whatnot. So that what you see happening on places like Tarawa with this huge, violent, bloody fight isn't going to be replicated by the time they get to Saipan and Guam and Tinian. You're going to see the Navy have massive leaps from, you know, going from surface warfare to naval aviation. You'll have the Battle of the Coral Sea, which is the first time two navies fought without ever even seeing one another. I mean, just fought completely in the heavens. And of course, the submarine warfare is so pivotal. You know, the war beneath the seas is what ultimately strangles Japan's economy. And I find that to be, in fact, I wrote an entire book about the submarine war. It's an overlooked area as well. Then you have strategic bombing. You see the rise, the development of the B-29, which of course is the largest, most powerful bomber built during World War II, capable of bridging these huge distances. It's going to transform the air war. It's going to lead to the rise of the independent air service. Of course, you're going to also have the armies going to be fighting from everywhere, from the Philippines all the way down through New Guinea. And of course, you have the Manhattan Project, which is going to be the dawn of the nuclear age. So, I mean, I think the Pacific is just such a uniquely American experience that I think more people need to be reading about it. More people need to be paying attention to it, you know?
So, absolutely.
And I'm biased, but I will also say, you know, there have been 1,000 books written on D-Day. And so, and when I wrote my book on the Battle of Manila, it was the first American book done on it of any real scholarship ever. So, I mean, there are so many great stories in the Pacific that have not been told yet. So much more that we can mine and that we can do. And as a historian, I love that. I love to have the opportunity to really plow these new fields and to dig into this material. But I do hope more and more people will continue to pay attention to it, read the books, follow it, because it is such an important part of our history.
Now, coming to the present day, there's, of course, the race towards what we call singularity AI, or in general, AI development. Do you see any parallels between what we're now trying to innovate and develop with AI as like kind of dual technologies and the atomic weapons and the atomic technology that was developed in the past? Do you see parallels between those two?
Yeah, I mean, warfare is changing dramatically right now. There's no doubt about it. And it's not just with AI. I mean, cyber warfare, when I was doing my master's a number of years ago in military history, cyber was all the big talk over at the Citadel where I am. Cyber is a big program that we have there. AI is a big part of that now as well. We're trying to kind of wrap our hands around how that's going to impact stuff. Drone warfare has been one of the biggest and most dramatic changes. I've been following very closely what's been going on out of Ukraine. I mean, you know, now look at what you can do for very little money with drones versus what we spend on, you know, huge air defense systems and whatnot. I mean, it's really unmanned systems are going to be the future as well. So, I mean, we're really at this just transformational moment in warfare. That is, you know, that countries that the United States is figuring out, other countries are. I mean, Ukraine has been demonstrating just how to do it. And we're smart to be paying very close attention to that. I mean, their attacks on, I mean, look, take a look at what's going on right now. Russia has lost how many warships now? Like 15 warships, 20 warships? Ukraine doesn't even have a navy. Yet they're doing all of this with drones. I mean, it is, like I'm saying, it is just, we're at a pivotal moment in technology and warfare. So
now, last question, James. So you lectured at top institutions, at presidential libraries. What is your biggest takeaway on what you're talking about the Japanese war and the World War II?
You know, I'll tell you, my biggest takeaway probably is, you know, it's hard for people to understand today the relationship that the United States had with Japan back then. I mean, look, I've been a public school teacher in Japan. I mean, to think that these two countries were once on this just, you know, horrific, you know, battle, you know, war against one another, and yet suddenly now we're incredible allies. I mean, I've got great friends in Japan and whatnot. I think that's probably one of the most positive, powerful things to come out of that war 8 decades later is the great relationship that the United States now does enjoy with Japan. I do think the other thing I will say is one of the big takeaways that I see firsthand is just what is going on in the Pacific. I mean, people do need to be paying attention. I mean, you are seeing the rapid remilitarization of that part of the world, from airfields on foreign islands like Tinian, like Peleliu, to everything that's going on out there. I mean, I would just encourage people pay attention. I mean, this is, you know, 8 decades is a long time ago, yes, on one hand, but it's not that long ago on the other. And so it's important that we continue to be vigilant.
James, we thank you so much for your time. Appreciate sharing your amazing discoveries about the war in Pacific and World War II. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a real pleasure.